What's up? It's your boys, Jordan and Abraham. He's a professional runner, so he's your fast friend. And I'm an MD PhD student, so I'm your smart friend. But as always, we are your friends who read One Piece. Firstly, I'd like to apologize. Sorry we were off last week. Jordan got COVID and he was feeling a little bit under the weather, so we couldn't record.
Bro, it
But
was
before we
terrible.
hop into the, I mean, you're feeling better now, right?
I am feeling better, man, but it's my third time getting COVID. I was messaging one of my boys, and he said, who also got COVID again right before US Champs this year, before the Olympic trials. He said, "Bro, COVID has us in his death note." Like COVID just like running around with a death note, and it's been writing my name in there. I've been chosen.
Dang,
So I'm
you
glad to be
have been.
feeling better. Sorry for being out last week, but
It's all good.
it's brutal being chosen for this. That's all I'll say.
It's all good. Before we hop into the new chapter this week, if you're listening on Spotify, please take a moment to rate us 5 stars. Feel free to reach out to us at our YouTube page, Friends Who Read One Piece, or on Twitter at FWROP Pod. We look forward to hearing from you. Jordan, we got chapter 1117 this week. I think the title is just Mo.
Mo.
Why don't you give me a rundown of what happened this week? What happened this in
Yes,
this
sir.
chapter?
But we start off watching Krieg's pirate crew on Pirate Island, Mont Blanc, Noland and his monkey pals, and Smoker on a banned new four-wheeler reacting excitedly to Vegapunk's news before we cut to a Navy General Hospital where all of Sword, I forgot all their names until I looked it up like just before writing this, is listening along with Kobe and Helmeppo and bandages in a hospital bed. "It looks like we're going to get some answers soon," Prince Grus remarks before Kujaku says, "It's our turn to step up." Abraham, is Sword finally going to make a move?
So it's funny, Morge actually put out a video related to the role of the Marines
Did he now? Did he now?
and the end game of the story. And I feel like this is kind of what Sword is getting at, where his point is basically that, the Marines are function as this arm of the world government, like the militaristic arm of the world government, because they believe that the world government is serving like the greater good of the world, right? So if all of this stuff is revealed that, the world government is committing genocide and that they're actually not this force for good that they're presenting themselves to be, then would the Marines turn on them, right? And that kind of feels like what Sword is getting at, what they're fun and not to say that they would ally themselves with like pirates, like the Straw Hats, but that they would almost be a third party that's like maybe like a militaristic coup kind of thing, where they're like, the world government clearly isn't fit to rule these people, so maybe we need to. I don't know.
I think that's pretty interesting. It reminds me when we were listening to, I think it was it Chin Guy? It was one of the vice admirals who was reacting as we were hearing Vegapunk's message saying, "Wait a second, like that's us. Like, wait a second." And so you're start I think you can begin to say, "Hey, maybe we're seeing some hints of there being some people who are starting to begin questioning exactly what the role of the world government is, whether they're actually the good guys." Even someone like Aokiji, who we don't know is an official member of Sword, could be seen as someone who, like, surely he's not the only person who was on Ohara when they're just blowing up civilian ships, who was like, "Wait a second, like this seems a little bit messed up." I think my question to you with that is, how big do you think this coup might be? Because I don't know if Vegapunk has said so much yet that it really has like turned the world upside down on the world government. Like, I don't know that regular people are start distrusting them. How big do you think this coup is? And do we know how big Sword is, how many members they have, or just we know a few prominent members of them?
I think we just know a few prominent members. I think the interesting thing I remember someone bringing up once is that Akainu might be a member of Sword, because I think he had like a tattoo of, in like in Wano we see him with like a tattoo of a sword or something like that on his arm or something. I can't
Interesting.
remember. Alex,
And
you can look it
I
up
would
maybe
guess
if
you
you.
disagree with that, right?
Yeah, I don't think Akainu being a member of Sword would not feel like, it doesn't feel like that would be in line with his beliefs and value system. I personally don't believe that. So I don't think Sword goes all the way up to the top like that. I think we've seen a couple of the more prominent members. I actually kind of I don't actually expect Aokiji to be a member of Sword. It feels like something that would be in line with like up his alley, kind of like what X-Drake is doing. And it wouldn't shock me at all if he was, but I kind of have the impression that Oda is writing Aokiji to be his own independent, like vigilante kind of thing. Like he's definitely not a real member of the Blackbeard Pirates, but I actually don't think he's still affiliated with the Marines in any way. And I think I want to get back to what you were saying about Vegapunk, how much Vegapunk is revealed. Because I agree, he didn't reveal a crazy, crazy amount, but I still do think the idea that the world will be flooded and it will be caused by the world government is enough to create concern that maybe even the Marines as a whole, like outside of Sword, mobilize against the world government. Maybe not just immediately after the Egghead incident, but if, water levels start to rise meter after meter after meter and these islands are disappearing, almost to confirm what Vegapunk predicted, then maybe at that point the Marines do revolt against the world government.
Did he re he revealed that the winners of the war are currently the world government, right? But did he reveal that they are re responsible for the man-made event that caused the seas to rise?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember exactly what his phrasing was when it, throughout his speech, but and maybe this is
I guess
us
he said that the
reading.
catastrophic event way back then with that war
Yeah.
with Joy Boy is what caused the seas to rise, but I guess it's still, I think it would still require some amount of dot connecting from the average person in the One Piece world to be able to figure
Yep.
out, to be able to get to like, I'm mad at the world government, for the average person anyway.
Yeah, because they don't know what us, the readers, know. That's fair.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on, what were
I
you saying?
mean,
Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
no, I mean, I think that's a fair point. I'd have to go back and look over his speech to see exactly how, I don't know if accusatory is the right word, but like how explicit
Right.
he is about saying that this was done by the 20 kings and the world government, to really know. And it looks like Alex, shared a photo of Akainu, yeah, with a sword on his arm. That's what I thought. But appreciate it, Alex. Thank you. So yeah, there was a chapter back in Wano where we do see that
Interesting.
Akainu has a sword at like on at the top of his bicep. So maybe
If he
Sword
is
does go all the way to the top, but
actually the president of Sword, that would be the craziest like 180 that he like. But I couldn't believe it. Like I couldn't
yeah.
believe it. Like blowing up the no, because the exact things that he's responsible for are the exact things that Sword like exists because they're unhappy with. Like
Yeah.
Kobe standing up to Akainu is like one of probably like a foundational moment for like people who are Sword, with people who are part of the world government. So I think I'm completely with you that I disagree that Akainu is part of Sword. What I'll say that
Yeah.
I also think is interesting from what you said earlier, just the one thing that it brought up for me, I also agree with you that it doesn't seem to me like Aokiji is part of Sword. It seems at the very least like Sword members are people who are deciding to try and reform the system from within.
Yeah.
And Aokiji, whatever he's doing, whatever sort of sense of justice he's pursuing, he's doing it by joining up with the Blackbeard Pirates and allying with, what seems at this point to be a force for evil. I think that now, to be fair, it makes me wonder kind of what Aokiji knows, like if he knows anything beyond the world, right? Because again, one of the things that I sort of think might happen is some sort of complexity between Luffy and Blackbeard and the decision that might end up having to be made at Laugh Tale, and that Blackbeard might be trying to make a decision that's completely different from Luffy's, but also very understandable in its own way. And so that kind of makes me wonder if that also makes me kind of wonder about if Aokiji kind of understands something about the choice that he's going to have to make. But I do really think that thematically I find the idea really compelling. Just when you're talking about Aokiji, I find the theme really compelling of people following their own justice in different ways and figuring out their own way to find justice. And whereas we see Kobe and Sword doing that in, or Kobe and, you know, Kobe, Drake, the other Sword members doing that by trying to reform it. Guys like Akiji doing it elsewhere. Guys like, you know, whatever Luffy's sense of justice is elsewhere. Obviously, we see more evil ones in different places. Yeah. But I think that's a really brought up.
I agree. We're gonna. I can't wait to learn more about why Aokiji specifically chose the Blackbeard Pirates, and you know what he's hoping to like get from partnering with them. And there's a lot we have to learn about Aokiji. But what else happened this chapter, Jordan?
Yeah, man. So we jump back to the crew. Nami notices the barrier around Egghead is lifting as Brook loads cola. So the crew is prepared for blastoff. But Jinbei and Zoro are lagging behind, chasing after Venus Juro, who's headed for the ship. As Venus Juro approaches the Sunny, Jinbei throws Zoro to protect the ship, and they clash. As Conqueror's haki spills out everywhere, Venus Juro notices Zoro's swords and remarks, a Kitetsu blade.
Yeah. So I think this is a big win for the people who, I don't know, shipped Venus Juro versus Zoro in the final battle, right? There was always this idea that, and I remember we talked about it. I remember you hated it, right? The idea that, oh, he's a swordsman and Zoro's a swordsman, so they're going to fight each other.
I don't want it to be a series of one by ones against the Elder Stars, and I don't like the we just see a sword with someone and that's it. But go on.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it was for me, it was always something that was reasonable that. We know that Zoro's opponent is always going to be someone who fights with swords. They might not necessarily be a swordsman, like Mr. One was not a swordsman. King was not a swordsman. But they fought with like bladed weapons, right? And the one person in the Gorosei who we expect to be kind of like Imu's inner circle, right? There was only one swordsman. So I thought it was just based off that was reasonable enough to try and project and be like, yeah, Zoro will fight him eventually. But him having the Shodai Kitetsu, I'm assuming, that almost confirms that this is going to be a fight that actually happens. Like, I don't want to say 100% because nothing's ever 100%, but like over like 90% for me that they're going to have an actual fight at the end game of the story.
I don't know if I would get to like 90%, but it definitely feels like it makes it much more likely. And like there's the potential for some sort of, it feels like there's the potential for some sort of history of, you know, how did Zoro get the sword? What are the Kitetsu blades? There's some sort of potential for like, there's some sort of potential for like understanding more about Zoro's history, which we've been waiting for, obviously, for, you know, 30 years, and we thought was going to happen in Wano. We've seen some of his ancestors. But I think at this point, we just like don't know what a Kitetsu blade is. I think that my reaction earlier, I think like there's just way too many times that we see, oh, Queen has a sword. Zoro's going to fight Queen. Yeah, this guy has
Did
a sword.
Queen had a sword?
Yeah, he had, it's like people saw a sword on him at one point, and like, he had like a big old, and everyone was like, oh, and so I think that I don't really like that as like a rationale for that's why Zoro's gonna end up fighting this guy. But I also think that I've been resistant to the idea that it's going to be I was the idea that it's just going to be like a series of 1v1s against the Elder Stars, where I think there's just like so much more potential for complexity over the course of the rest of the series. But you know, like it definitely does seem to be leaning that way. And if we're going to end up getting some more history, I just wonder where Mihawk would show up and all that.
Yeah. So that's been we could talk about Mihawk, I've always had a little bit of a hard time figuring out where to place, Cross Guild in the whole story. Right. Because we do like Zoro has to fight Mihawk. He has to. Right, like 100%. There's no way the story ends without Zoro defeating Mihawk. Now the question is, do you expect Zoro versus to take that title from him at the absolute end of the story, kind of like an epilogue where we have like a one chapter, like after the final war where Zoro's fighting Mihawk. I personally don't really expect that because I feel like it would feel anticlimactic for me, right? That we just get like a, or like, you know, the classic thing when a series is wrapping up, like five pages or whatever, yeah. Maybe a couple pages depicting a Zoro versus a Mihawk fight, Zoro wins. Like, this is one of the more meaningful moments that we've been building to since the Baratie AR, right?
Yeah, so I mean, since like chapter 60, right? Like,
yeah. So in my head, Zoro versus Mihawk has to happen earlier in the story, right? So the way I've kind of reasoned the timeline in my head is as such that Cross Guild will show up, because we know they're going after the One Piece now, that right, they'll show right. up either on right before Laugh Tale or at Laugh Tale in order to try and, you know, find the One Piece. And it's at that point, it's at that point that Zoro will fight Mihawk. Let me rephrase this. I think the Blackbeard Pirates and the Straw Hat Pirates will fight on Laugh Tale over the One Piece. And this will happen before the final battle of the series, because as you know, I expect Imu to actually be the final villain of the series. We don't need to get into all of that, but they get to Laugh Tale, they fight the Blackbeard Pirates. As they're leaving Laugh Tale, maybe the Cross Guild shows up because they're also pursuing the One Piece, and that's when Zoro fights Mihawk and defeats him, takes the title of Strongest Swordsman, and then goes into the final battle against the world government with the title of Strongest Swordsman, is in my head how the timeline works. If you have a different timeline, what do you think the timeline would be?
It's hard for me to imagine that we're going to get Straw Hats versus the Blackbeard Pirates and then have like two more fights, right? Like, and then we fight Mihawk and then we fight. I'm like, man, what if Mihawk is actually like Im's brother? You know, they got the same eyes. Like, what if Mihawk is actually like can do the summoning and is like a different part of their like fragmented consciousness. You know what I'm saying? Like, could Zoro and Mihawk have like a competition to decide who's going to defeat Venus Juro? Like, are they going to end up like working together to like defeat him somehow, like as part of this giant coalition that's fighting all of the world government, because no one, even Mihawk, can't handle Venus Juro, because being the world's strongest swordsman is different than being the world's strongest centaur horse demon. I don't know. But I think definitely it creates some kind of interesting possibilities to have a character like that who's going to exist towards the end of the series.
For sure. And one last thing I want to say about that is another reason why I think Zoro has to have his Blackbeard Pirate fight first before the Mihawk fight is that if he fights someone like Shiryu in the Blackbeard Pirates, having already defeated Mihawk.
I feel like there's no tension there.
Right?
Because you can't be the world's strongest swordsman and then just fight like some other swordsman who wasn't even the previous world's strongest swordsman.
Exactly. So that's another reason why I expect the Blackbeard Pirates fight to happen before the Mihawk fight. But what else did we have going on this chapter?
So we get to the final section of the chapter where the Giants prepare their ship for launch as they endure an assault from Vice Admiral Bluegrass and a heavy rock and roll blaster from Vice Admiral Dahl. And as Luffy, Dory, and Bragi reach the shoreline and prepare to board the ship, the five elders surround the Iron Giant and notice that it's the one who attacked Marajoa. Abraham, they look a little bit traumatized over there. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so this is, I guess, further confirmation that the Gorosei have just been around for a long time, right? Like, they've clearly been around for at least 200 years. I think all of us have speculated that they've been around since the Void Century. So,
right.
When I first read this before you pointed this line out, I didn't think all that much of it, to be honest, because I was like, yeah, of course they recognize the robot. They were around 200 years, right? But Oda's never actually confirmed that for a fact.
Right.
And so this is confirmation that they were at least around 200 years ago, which I guess you could say is a medium-sized reveal, right? Them looking traumatized, I feel like that was more a reflection of what Vegapunk was saying. Like, they pulled up on the Iron Giant and they were like, we need to stop this broadcast right now because Vegapunk is about to reveal some real shit. That's what I thought the looks on their faces were more in reference to, rather than to what the Iron Giant might have done 200 years ago.
That's interesting, because I definitely saw it as being, at the very least, representative that it's something kind of significant. You know, the way he stops, like, wait a sec, is that? You know, you have a whole panel of his eyes looking very of a, is that Jupiter? No, Jupiter's the worm guy.
Yes.
Whichever one, you know, bird guy is, right?
Mars. That's Mars.
That's Mars. Okay, yeah, because Mercury is the boar. Yeah. So you have Mars, like, with a close up of his eye. You have Mercury saying there can be no doubt of that. And I actually went in the Roz just because I happened to have the Roz up to look at the the end of this chapter. You know, there's a certain thing in Japanese where you see little dots after each word that's like saying this is important. Like, I am saying this with emphatically. And when he says, like, there's no mistake, there's no doubt of that, I think for a group of characters who refer to everyone as insects, like, basically, oh, this is something we don't care about, this is something that we don't care about, all these people, you know, how can I tell if I could kill Kaku or kill Kaku or not, or spare him, because who know, you know, there's no way to know which insects I trample on. I think there's the level of realization and recognition that they have for the power that this robot has, or at the very least the impression that it left on them, is pretty significant. And it really makes me wonder what the cause of that attack was, and exactly how much havoc it was able to wreak in Marajoa for them to really have that level of memory. Like, what did it do to leave such a strong impression on these guys who look at everything else as nothings?
Yeah, you know, that's fair. I guess I didn't read it like that. It's hard to speculate because we don't know anything about what happened back then, right? We know it showed up, it wreaked havoc, and then went away for whatever reason, right?
I'll say that I think these ongoing
these
ongoing, like, friends of Joy Boy, like, such as the Iron Giant, such as Zunisha, I think these sort of ongoing friends who are still around in the world clearly have a certain level of power, and at the very least a certain level of ability to accomplish something special in the world.
So here's the thing. Zunisha, for example, we saw, while she had strength on her own, obviously, like, she absolutely destroyed Jack and his crew once she got the order to attack. She was very, very vulnerable in that, you know, she couldn't do anything without an order, and that if Jack had kept on blasting, like, the whole island would have sunk, right? Like,
right.
I didn't get the impression from Zoe that Zunisha was anything all that powerful. Maybe that's the wrong impression, because obviously she did one shot Jack and his whole crew. That shit was a flex.
And
right?
Remember, she was also about to take out a whole marine, an entire, like, marine fleet if Momonosuke had commanded her.
I guess I didn't, you know,
like, Zunisha. Remember, Zunisha couldn't do anything without the command. But, like, once you get commanded to do something, right? And it seemed like this Iron Giant got some commands.
Yeah, that's fair. But the Iron Giant's also getting bodied right now by it was just Warkiri that attacked it, right? It wasn't even like all four that.
They all showed up in front of it. They all, but the only one we saw definitely attacking it was Warkiri.
Yeah. So I don't know. And, you know, it's been 200 years. Maybe this thing is, like, old and not as strong as it was in its prime, kind of thing. Though that feels kind of weird for a robot, because it's a robot, like, not an organic being.
Right.
The robot was that. I'll give you this. The robot and what it could accomplish in terms of strength feat-wise was definitely hyped up a lot more than what we saw in this chapter. To the point where it was like, oh, the transmission is coming from the giant robot. And I even thought that this robot might put up a fight against the And who's to say? Maybe next chapter some shit changes. But
in this moment, it is definitely getting bodied. I'll say that.
Yeah. So
that's what it looks like at this moment. I think we'll go on to see. We'll go on to see a little bit more, and we'll maybe talk a little more about that later. But finally, as we get towards the end of this chapter, Vegapunk's message concludes with the message that is the title of the chapter. He says, "Those of you who carry the letter D in your name," as we see reactions from Dragon, Sabo, Kobe, and Blackbeard, "among you, there is mo—" And the broadcast cuts out as the Iron Giant is attacked by the elders. Abraham, what do you think?
Yeah. So the scans that I read, they translated them. They said the mo could be translated as either the first part of another word, like more or whatever, most, like of another word, or that it could be translated to mean also. I obviously can't read Japanese, unlike some other people. So I'm dependent on people who can read Japanese to explain the possibilities.
You know, that's that.
Alex, do you know anyone who can read Japanese?
Man, I swear to God.
I do have this one friend who claims he's pretty good at it.
Man, I swear to God. You waited until I was just about to start speaking and thanking you for being so kind as to have acknowledged this. And as I was had just been ready to get out of my seat, you hit me with that. So well done. That was very rude. Yes, I would love to tell you what I see in this as someone who does read Japanese pretty well. So what the part that's sort of like whatever it's translated as, right? Like, you know, with among you, there is a, what he says is, "Omae-san tachi no naka ni mo." And so like the mo can, it can mean also, and it can also mean, it can also like mean more. I think if we're trying to like predict what it is as some kind of like the beginning of a Japanese word or the beginning of a name, that seems like it would be almost impossible to do. It also seems a lot less likely coming after, like what's a little weird is that there's like, it's like after ni, there's like an ellipsis, right? And then mo, there's an ellipsis, which I think I'm just kind of reading as things cutting out. But I, you know, it's like ni, mo. But I think what it feels like to me is they're suggesting that, it reads to me as within, like also within you there is something like that. And so it brings up for me some that it's going to bring up like whatever the core characteristic and or the core, if there's any kind of actual like bloodline, lineage, like whatever, it's something that is inside all of them that would be passed on, which I think sort of makes sense as we begin to learn about this idea that the war is still going on.
Yeah. So the more I feel like I learn about the D clan and the will of, and the people who have the initial D in their name, the less I feel like there is some bloodline or something that unifies or some common philosophy that unites them. I guess what I think about someone like Roger versus someone like Rocks. I think about someone like Luffy versus someone like Blackbeard, right? Jeez. And they just seem so ideologically like different from one another, right? And maybe you could make the argument that someone like Blackbeard represents the extreme of a philosophy like Luffy, like unbridled freedom resulting in chaos. Right. And maybe that is what the will of D or the D clan represents. But I just have a hard time finding something that unites all of these different members of the D clan, right? So that's why I can't remember who, I think it was, I can't remember what my cousin said, but my cousin Aaron in the group chat was talking about, well, you know, what could the more mean? Is it like more one, or one of you is also a traitor. One of you is also a, you know, like, I think there's a lot of interesting possibilities that are going to be hard to speculate on. But to me, it doesn't feel like this will be something that unites everyone. Like, one, you know what I mean? I feel like I'm maybe not explaining myself all that well.
I think I know what you mean. And to me, it's like what I, the way I understand the idea of them being united is not so much that. So if you take, for example, what we know about the D is that they're the enemies of the gods, right? Mm-hmm. And the way we've seen that manifest has been really different for different characters. So just like the ones you just said, right? Luffy and Teach. Roger and Rox. So whether, like, yes, there might be something about freedom or whatever, but as I think, to me, it starts to begin feeling like as we, if we think, like, it's there are different ways that resisting whatever the world government and, like, the side of, you know, whatever 800-year-old war we're talking about, there are different ways of resisting that that are still resisting it, but are completely ideologically different. And so they result in people who are not actually aligned with each other, despite both being enemies of the same people. And I think that that's the piece that makes me think about this war and the long history of it, feeling, makes me feel like that's the ongoing part of this war, right? Like, so when we think about what has Vegapunk been talking about? Well, he said Joy Boy is the first pirate, like the sun god Nika. He said there's these people who, you know, made the sea levels rise a bunch. And remember, his talking about the D clan and saying among you there is also is a continuation of those things and a continuation of the idea that the war, that the 800-year-old war is still going on. To me, it wouldn't surprise me if he says, if he was intending to say something along the lines of, within you, there's, so, you know, the will of whatever, like a sign of whatever faction of the war, like mm-hmm. a sign of something that connects them to this 800-year-old war that we just learned about.
Maybe it's related to what Whitebeard says before he dies, where he's, where he tells Teach that, you're not the man that Roger is waiting for.
You're not
right?
the man Roger's waiting for, yeah.
That there is one particular person within the D clan that, who we all speculate to be Luffy, obviously, that
right.
satisfies these requirements, right?
Right. That's interesting for me. And what could, you know, when we learned about the war too, that made me think as well about Whitebeard's last words and like what, last words to Teach and exactly what that might potentially mean for the exactly what that might potentially mean for the end game, you know, what it means to be the man Roger's waiting for. So really a lot of interesting stuff this chapter, I'd say, like pretty a lot to pick apart and unpack. But is it time for some awards, Abraham, now that the chapter's over?
Oh, it's definitely time for some awards. You want me to go first?
I would love for you to go first. So it's time for awards show where we give awards to noteworthy moments you might have missed. What do you got?
My award is the Shohei Ohtani Award. Shohei is...
Didn't I give that already? I swear I gave Shohei Award one time. I gave it when he used the bat. But go on. I want to hear what you got.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm actually glad you say that because, you know, what's one thing that Shohei was really, really famous for, why he was such a great baseball player, it's not just because he was such a great hitter. It was because he could both hit and pitch, right? He was one of the few pitchers in the league actually an unbelievable hitter.
Right.
And so Jinbei is actually getting my Shohei Ohtani Award for the way he just launched Zoro. Perfect accuracy right at Venus Juro. And I feel like it's appropriate. We had a Shohei Ohtani Award of Luffy swinging a bat, and now we have a pitching one, right? It's both sides of this guy.
I kind of like that. And Shohei's been a pretty regular feature in the culture part of our show. So I got to say, I like that award. I'm glad we're giving Shohei more recognition and appreciation.
There you go.
You know, I'm sure he really cares that we're doing this after hearing about everything that happened with his translator. He was really sad. You know, he's been in a slump lately.
If you want to come on the show, Jordan can act as your translator. I'm sure he won't steal any money from you. I don't know. He might. I don't know. Actually, know him that.
I would never. Well.
I've never trusted him with any money. But you're welcome to come on the show whenever you want, Shohei.
Yeah, man. So my award this week is the We Forgot It. I really forgot you existed award. And that goes to Don Krieg and his Pirates. Because honestly, I don't even think I would recognize it as the Krieg Pirates if the spoilers had not told me that that was the Don Krieg Pirates. And I can't even believe they made it all the way to Pirate Island after what they had been through. I guess they came back on the Grand Line. You got to see Jin again. And I thought that that was going to be the one person from all of One Piece that we just never saw again.
Yeah, that was, I'll be honest, I didn't notice that those were the Krieg Pirates until I heard people bring that up. And then I looked again and I was like, I guess I kind of see, what's his name, Pearl. But I don't know. I still have a hard time making that. I was like, okay, I guess that kind of looks like Jin. I didn't recognize them at all until it was pointed out to me.
Well, Jin grew his hair out, man. Jin grew his hair out. You know, and Krieg, Krieg also grew his hair out, I guess. And Pearl still has the same ridiculous outfit. So I guess that's
Pearl
was
the
one
that was easy enough to recognize, but
otherwise we'd be lost.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Abraham? What do we got going into 11? We have no break next week, so we're going to 11. 18, is it?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. I think this arc is going to wrap up a lot like Enies Lobby wrapped up. Where, because there's two ways to go down, right? In Whole Cake Island, we started to flee the island, and then there was this whole saga of trying to actually get off the island. Don't expect something like that to happen.
Right.
I think it's going to be more like Enies Lobby in that they're going to sail off. The robot is going to be quote unquote killed. We're probably going to get some narrator speech bubbles summarizing the, maybe not summarizing the events of Egghead Island, but like, you know, the whole, and on this day, blah, 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 kind of
about
the Egghead Island incident. And I think there's a good chance we see Elbaf, like we start to approach Elbaf to be like, we're starting in Elbaf as early as next chapter.
Wow, that'd be very fast to get to Elbaf.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Oda has not spent the time to actually draw those scenes where people are just adventuring or traveling from island to island nowadays. Like he used to in the past, I feel like just spend time, with the crew on the boat going from island to island. Nowadays, it's just kind of like that time is just cut out. So I don't really expect us to get anything there.
That's fair. I think I honestly would love if we actually got a little bit of that. I think we might have maybe a few more chapters in Egghead, but you're right that it's definitely wrapping up. And I'll tell you, I'm going back and reading through some of my old volumes. I love some of those just like scenes of everyone on the ship and Nami getting mad at everyone and, you know, Chopper and Usopp like screwing around with Luffy. So I certainly hope we get some of those. But yeah, I think you're right that we're not too far away, whether it's one chapter or not. Seeing Elbaf next week would be a little bit fast for me. But
all right.
I would say my prediction. I think the robot's got to give us a little more than this, man. The robot has got to give us a little more than this.
Maybe.
I think we already have enough info to understand what the Egghead Island incident is. I don't think we need anything else for it to be this, you know, the event that shakes the world in the way that they said it is. Although I wonder, it would be interesting if there was something else that happened. But I feel like this has been, for this robot like running around rampaging, being this like first giant robot that we ever saw, I feel like it's been a poor showing. And so I want a little bit more. I think in this next chapter, the robot's going to have a little bit more life in it than we've seen previously.
Yeah. I can't say I agree with that prediction. I think the robot is kind of done, but I wouldn't be mad at it. I wouldn't be mad if we saw the robot get to throw some hands.
Well, everyone loves a robot fight, man. Let's make it a mecha anime.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. It's time for us to continue the new segment that we created last episode called the One Piece Draft. Over the next couple episodes, Jordan and I will each be drafting a group of five pirates with the goal of building a crew that can find the One Piece. Alex, can you give us a summary of the rules and maybe the crewmates that have been drafted to each team so far?
Yeah, just in case you missed the first week, each week we're going to alternate between Abraham and Jordan on who picks first. Abraham got the first pick last week of Robin, and Jordan drafted Shanks. So Jordan's going to be up first this week. Each pick must consist of a pirate and a cannon crew that they were part of. You are not allowed to select any pirates who have been to Laugh Tale. And once a crew has been named, it is off limits for the rest of the draft, which means no more Straw Hats and no more Red Hair Pirates. Jordan, what are you thinking for your second crew member?
You know, I've been thinking about this for a little while. I've been very difficult to decide who it's going to be. Now, it seems very clear from the beginning of this that Abraham and I are going to have different philosophies with this. Yeah. Your boy is definitely going to have a strong crew. I said, who should I take? And it's got to be my boy Shirohige, bro. We going Whitebeard.
Oh man, that's a solid pick. That's actually who I probably would have, who I would have taken if you didn't take him right there. Very, very strong pick. Now I will
he's
say
he's strong. Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead, go ahead. You can.
We got one of the strong, I mean, known as the world's strongest man. Well, not the strongest creature. It's supposed to be Kaido, but he kind of had a weak showing. But strongest man, we saw him go up against the Marines. He would take them down. Homie was good friends with Roger. So he certainly knows certain things about, you know, the One Piece, about Laugh Tale. And he definitely has not had interest in going there. But I wonder, it'd be interesting if he actually wanted to try, knowing what he had. He also had spent some time with Odin. So, you know, he knows some things about One Piece. And obviously, he's just a really good guy. He loves his crew. He's relatively amicable. And he and Shanks, despite being adversaries, clearly seem to have a level of rapport between them that's going to not make our crew go completely crazy. So we got two boys, Conqueror's Haki, very strong.
This extremely strong crew. But one, Whitebeard already told you the problem with having multiple Conqueror Haki users on a crew. He said that's why he didn't actually want to have Odin on his crew originally. He's like, I've seen the issues that can come up when you have so many Conqueror Haki users on the same ship.
I need that quote, but I'm curious. Yeah,
he does. When Alex, you can pull it up for us while I'm making my pick. But it's right as Odin is trying to join his crew that he does say that. I will say Shanks is probably the ideal Conqueror's Haki user because he's not going to try and rock the boat or fight Whitebeard. I don't think he would. I don't know if he necessarily would submit to being his subordinate, but you've got a strong ass crew. You just don't have much. You're just not going to get off Don Island. This is the problem.
Man, get out of here, man. We get enough Don Island, bro. Get out of here, bro. that's ridiculous. We're at least getting further than that. But I need to know who you're taking next, because all I'm saying is we can just take you captive right now. Like, you're not getting anywhere near Laugh Tale if here's, we run up here's and it's my, me here's and Shanks my next, and Whitebeard versus Robin.
Yeah. My next pick is going to be someone with a lot of strength. Because you're right. One of the requirements that you need to be able to find the One Piece is strength. You can't, it doesn't matter how skilled, if you have the best navigators, if you have all, you're not going to get there if you don't have strength. So the person that I'm actually going to take is Dracul Mihawk.
That was like the two people I was between was Mihawk and Whitebeard. Yeah. And I didn't want you to take White Mihawk. So I thought about taking him, but then I feel like you might have taken Whitebeard if I didn't take Mihawk. So
I told you I had two picks in my head. I knew I was taking one of those two guys. Right.
Right. Right.
I actually, the other reason why I like Mihawk is that we know he's been able to navigate through the grand...
I knew you were going to say that. This is like, that is almost why I know that's almost why I took him. Cause I was like, Abraham's going to be all annoying about oh, your crew isn't functional. Your crew just has a bunch of strong guys. And I was going to be like, no, but Mihawk has been rolling. Man.
Yeah. You should have taken Mihawk. Yeah. Cause he literally just goes solo through the Grand Line and has been fine for decades. So
I want to call you out. I want to call you out real quick, Abraham. He has been flying solo for quite a while. And in the rules of this draft, you need to pick a crew that Mihawk.
But he's a part of Cross Guild.
So you're picking Cross Guild.
I can't even be mad because I would have these are all the things I would have said. Like I would have thought these are all the things I would have said if Abraham was getting on me for choosing Mihawk. Because I thought it was a good pick.
Yeah, it's a great pick.
Yeah. But it's also tough too because it's like I can't like the thing about Mihawk is he doesn't take anyone else off the board, whereas Whitebeard takes a lot of guys
for sure. A lot of guys off the board. Marco is, I mean, outside of Whitebeard, you know, I would have loved to have someone like Marco on my crew. You know, I need a doctor, I need a strong fighter. Like Marco would be amazing, but Whitebeard's a strong pick. Alex, did you manage to find that quote by Whitebeard or no? About too many conquerors users, or
I was looking for it. I did see someone mentioning Kaido saying something similar.
Okay, I can we can find it for next week or something like that. But I remember Whitebeard saying that.
Man, Kaido just not a dude who can get along. But honestly, he and Big Mom got along for a second at the end. So you know, I mean, maybe I should have started with Kaido and Big Mom here. You know what I'm saying?
Oh man. Yeah.
Well, we got three more weeks, three more characters to draft. I kind of wish that Mihawk would have somehow slipped through two more, but it probably wasn't going
to
happen.
Mihawk was never making it back to you.
Yeah, that's a shame. At least it makes me feel better about choosing one or the other. So, I think it's time to move on to the culture. Alex, tell us what we got.
Yeah, well, we got a lot of conversations around basketball this week. You know, the Mavs and the Celtics are in the finals. Mavs are getting their butts handed to them a little bit. I think right now they're 3-0.
They won last night. So they blew the Celtics out last night by like 40. So it's now 3-1.
I'm so glad they got a game.
I thought the next game was tonight, bro.
No, it was last night.
I would have watched it. I just thought it was tonight.
Yeah. No, it was last night.
Oh, crud. I was busy being in New York, man, being tired.
Yeah. But, sorry, keep on going, Alex.
No, I wanted to hand it off to you, Abraham. I mean, you've got a couple of funny stories about Make-A-Wish kid and...
Yeah.
Now who's the GOAT on the Celtics? Some heat being thrown back and forth.
Yeah. So, do you know who the coach for the Mavericks is, Jordan?
Jason Kidd
has to be the most. Is duplicitous the right word? This man is just. There's always a motive behind everything he says and does. Right.
Right. Right.
Even as a coach, he's like, he had one incident years ago where he was out of timeouts, for example, and he told his player to like bump into him so he could spill his drink and get an extra stoppage and what. He's always trying to like play mind games and get like an upper hand. And it was kind of funny that at the start of this series, Jason Tatum he's almost pretty much unanimously considered the best player on the Boston Celtics, right? He's from St. Louis. Really proud. I love Jason Lewis. And Jaylen Brown, who has like a great game one against the Mavericks. So the reporters are asking him and they're like, you know, what's the challenge with defending Jaylen Brown? Like, why is it so hard? He's like, of course it's hard to defend Jaylen Brown because, you know, he's their best player. And everyone is like, you know, now people are like bringing it up to Tatum and stuff. And they asked him after like game three, they're like, you know, we know you were trying to like play games and, you know, get in their head about, you know, having them have in internal discourse about, oh, I'm better than you. You're better than me kind of. He's like, no, I believe it. Jaylen Brown's their best player. And he like just keeps on doubling down on this. I thought it was hilarious. track is more of an individual sport for you, I guess, than a team sport like this. But I even remember asking you when you came to St. Louis to race, I was like, so who should I bet on to finish first between you and your buddies? And
yeah,
you like
yeah,
confidently
yeah.
told me that it would be you. And then you came in last amongst the three of them.
This is how he wants to do. Listen, the smart I want to say that really quick. The smart money in that race was on me. I had just beaten Liam like 2 weeks before, leading from the very beginning the whole time.
Yeah.
Julius is his mile PR, whatever I ran in that time is like faster than his PR. Yeah. It was not a matter of ego. It was a matter of if I was sitting next to someone who, if it was like, Sam Prakel or something, and you say, who are you going to bet on in a mile? It's, like I called my coach before that race another year, and it was the year I ran against Amos, my high school teammate who's an Olympian for Germany. And his actual event is the 1500, right? So in a 5K, I think we would have had a pretty good race. But in 15, in the mile, you know, the odds are we're very heavily against. I said, Ray, I said, what are the odds I can beat Amos? He said, is he going to fall?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, to me, it's not a matter of, like, for me personally, and I think this is why that in whatever sport I happen to be good at, I would have been successful, is it's not a matter of, like, ego and just saying, oh, I just believe I'm the best, and that's how you're going to do it, right? It's like, understanding like whatever your role is and being able to that's be a role player, be happy for your teammates, be able to be successful together, I think that's an important thing. And you can still be a really good athlete and maximize while having that attitude.
I guess my question is, when you get to a certain level, like you're comparing yourself to someone who like qualified for the Olympics, right? But these are two people who are
I beat a lot of guys who qualify for the Olympics, right? Like
No.
I beat the Olympic silver medalist once in a cross country race, you know, in the 1500. Yeah, yeah. So, hey, let's be clear, you know.
I got you. I was giving you a hard time, but
clear, you know, when you're saying, "Oh, this is someone who let's be clear for a second now. Like, I beat some guys, all right?"
Yeah. I got you. But like I feel like when you get to the level of athlete that someone like Jaylen Brown is, you know, where he was probably always the best player on his high school team, probably the best player in his college, like where he can justly feel like, hey, I won Eastern Conference Finals MVP. I'm the favorite to win Finals MVP right now. Why can't I be the best player on the team? You know, and I just wonder how good athletes at that level, how hard it is to set your ego aside and be like, no, my teammate's better. Even if you're just saying it for like press speak or whatever. Like, there's, it's one thing for you to be, like, beside Noah Lyles and be like, yeah, obviously Noah is better than me. Obviously. He's the best, you know, sprinter in the world or whatever.
Right. Yeah, right? Of course. Yeah.
But if you were, like...
Can I tell you a story about that real quick? Hold on.
Okay.
Basically, like, you know, I was one of these first guys who came out talking about anime in a post-race interview, right? And, like, since then, obviously Noah's done it. A lot of other... Isaiah Jewett, a lot of other athletes have come out talking about anime. I was, like, the first, like... came out saying like black guys love anime, like my hair's up like Shikamaru, like, and so there was at one point some high school kid who, you know, wanted an interview with Noah Lyles and they got him on it and they just had me as like a second personality, right? I know Noah because, you know, my agent was his agent. I was like one of the lesser guys, right? Like I wouldn't, but so me and Noah went on this podcast with Sidious Mag. It's out there somewhere. And like this high school kid. And I guess the girl doing the interview, she, you know, she's like, yeah, you're there with like, you know, two of your favorite. And I'm like, two, like this new kid didn't know who I am. And she goes on like, she's like, oh, do you want advice from, and she has to ask from Noah. And I was like, oh, you, like, I was actually surprised. She was trying to like include me. And I was like, listen, like, I know why I'm here. Like, I am not Noah Lyles. I'm here because I'm a dude who talked about anime in a post-race interview once, and I'm a good interview. So I'm really happy to be here. You know, I have a perfect understanding of exactly how I relate to Noah Lyles, to your point.
Yeah. But I guess my point was, if you were the number two sprinter in the world, you might not be as willing to concede that he's better than you, right? I guess that's my point, where when someone like Jason Kidd says that about Jaylen Brown, I wonder how effective that actually is. Cause I could see that getting into someone's head, especially if you're like, everyone always talks about me like I'm the number two, I'm not as good as this guy, but like why can't I be better than this guy?
Yeah, well, it's you can believe that and you don't have to let it kill your team chemistry. And to be fair, you see that all the time, right? Like it's like when band members had to go solo, and often it's like one is successful and the other one is like, oh man, maybe it wasn't actually the other guy.
That's what happened with
Shaq and Kobe. Yeah, Shaq and Kobe actually were both very good. But it's sort of like you just don't want to actually let that. Your success is going to be greater when you're together, and it's a question of if at least one of them is able to put the ego aside enough to actually say that, like, hey, I'm going to be better off just being a teammate. That's what you can do. I think it's possible to be part of a really good team and still continue to be an amazing athlete if that's the case. But it's just a question of if that's going to happen. Hopefully it doesn't end up ruining you know, what the Celtics have going.
For sure. And they've been together for so long that I think they'll be fine. I want to transition to another basketball topic now.
Wait, right. Before we jump to the WNBA, you got to tell the anecdote about.
Right. Sorry. Thanks, Chad. I forgot about that. Also, there was a Make-A-Wish kid that went up to Jason Kidd. I guess maybe he's from Dallas or something like that, but the Make-A-Wish Foundation set these two up. And then he was like, yeah, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to meet Luka Doncic? Do you want to meet Kyrie Irving? We can set that up. And this kid was like, I'm a Celtics fan. I want you to lose. And he was like, just lose. He's like, I don't want to meet any of these players. I thought that was one of the cheekiest things that this kid could have said.
It's definitely it's good seeing Jason Kidd get some of the mind games he's trying to play played on him. That's what I like to see. That's what I like to see.
All right. So I want to talk about Caitlin Clark, because Caitlin Clark has been everywhere right now. She's been she was recently left off of the Olympic team, and she's been subject to what I think some people would call hazing in the WNBA. So for those of you who don't know, Caitlin Clark is a women's basketball player. She has basically all the NCAA records for scoring and assists. And she's like a phenomenal, phenomenal player. And she's actually been one of the few female basketball players that's been able to pull big numbers. Like all of her college basketball games were doing better broadcast numbers than the men's college basketball games. And they were even pulling better numbers than a lot of NBA playoff games. Like, people want to tune in and watch Caitlin Clark hoop. And she recently entered the WNBA a couple of weeks ago. And a lot of people have taken issue with her for a couple things. One, she happens to be white in a sport that's dominated by black women. And to some degree, she's also... She is a heterosexual female in a league that has a large proportion of its athletes that are part of the LGBTQ community. A lot of, I think, mostly lesbian women in the W. So people have, I guess, people in the WNBA who have for years been telling men and other people who consume sports to invest into the WNBA, to put eyes on the WNBA, have now been taking a lot of issue with the attention that Caitlin Clark is bringing, given that this attention is only coming when a cis white woman has entered the league. And I guess this has bled into like politics, with like Jill Biden inviting Caitlin Clark's team to the White House even after they lost in the national championship, and it's caused a lot of strife. What do you think about the female athletes in the WNBA who I think have shown some degree of resentment towards Caitlin, despite the attention and money that she's brought to their league?
Like, as an athlete, like what are they supposed to do? You know what I'm saying? Like as an athlete, I'm not like, oh, I'm thankful that you're making track more pop. Like,
yeah,
whenever, like, it's like when there's like high school phenoms, like college, like whatever, it's like you don't want to lose to these kids. You don't want to lose these newbies. You don't want to lose these inexperienced people who are just like showing up like that. And so I very much feel like when you talk about these athletes, it's, you know, the idea that they're supposed to just be thankful that she's bringing eyes to it. And the idea that those eyes are coming to it only as a matter of Caitlin Clark and not about the game of basketball, to me, is ridiculous.
I disagree with that. So I'll put it this way. When LeBron first entered the league in 2003, right, there were a ton of quotes from, you can go back and see his teammates that were on the Cavs his rookie year saying, we don't need this high school kid. You know, he might not like make the rotation, blah, blah. Like they were basically just hating on LeBron, right?
Sure.
The idea that there was this high school kid that was going to come into the league and save the team, which he ended up doing because he's one of the fucking greatest basketball players
right.
And I think not acknowledging the effect that Caitlin Clark has had on viewership in the WNBA is straight up, I don't know if ignorant is the right word, but it's just factually, you look at the, I think, average games involving Caitlin Clark's team have on average of like 17 to 20,000 viewers per match, like, and they fill up NBA stadiums, whereas games that don't have Caitlin Clark in them this season pull like an average of like 7 to 8,000 viewers, right? So to say that a lot of the eyes and money that is coming to the league is not directly due to Caitlin Clark, I think is factually incorrect. Now, I'm not saying
it's unrelated, but I'm saying the idea that these athletes are supposed to just be like, oh, it's because it's Caitlin Clark.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'm not saying they have to get down on bended knee and be like, she's the best. You know, I'm so grateful that she's in the league. It's more that I think some of the response to Caitlin Clark and the viewership that she's bringing has been a little bit hypocritical, because as someone who does, I consume a lot of NBA basketball, right? I don't watch any college basketball. I don't watch the WNBA. I don't watch Euro basketball. I really only watch the NBA, right? And there's been a lot of people who have vocalized that the reason why the WNBA is not successful is because they don't have the support from largely male viewers they don't have enough support from basketball fans, which are largely male viewers, to support their league, right?
Right.
And
right.
Now there's this idea that people are tuning in. And the league is becoming more successful. Instead of them flying like commercial flights, they have like charter flights and charter planes specifically for these teams. And like the salaries of these WNBA players is going to go up and their working conditions are going to be better, right? But it's almost like it's not good enough because it didn't happen in the way that they wanted it to happen. Because it didn't happen when it was... You know, let's say like Angel, like because Angel Reese entered the league or something like that, or because some like maybe black or lesbian, like it was a cis white woman who entered the league and that caused people to pay attention. And I feel like people are kind of shooting themselves in the foot when they're like, we want you to pay attention to our league, but we're unhappy that you're paying attention to the league because it's because of this particular athlete. You know, it feels hypocritical to me that
I think there's this, one thing where,
yeah,
I think one thing is it's a lot to ask. Like, it's the idea of like all money is not good money is the first thing, right? And so to me, I don't understand it. And I'm not necessarily saying that the money that comes from Clayton Clark is not good money, but in a lot of situations, there's money that you might have the opportunity to get, and yeah. Would you feel good about taking that money, right? It's like, I would love to have $10 million. Now, yeah. If I could have $10 million and that $10 million comes by kicking a bunch of poor people out of their homes and then like selling those homes or something like that, right? Like, that is not the way I want to make $10 million, right? That's obviously like an extreme example. And so I think the idea of saying that, these women don't, what they want is not just money and saying, oh, we want more money. It's they want to be recognized as the kind of athletes that they feel that they are, right? Like they right. want people to recognize their sport of women's basketball as being the athletic feat competition that is like worth talking about and worth following. And so when we suggest in the way, when we say, oh, it's just like all Caitlin Clark, it's not about women's basketball. So they're shooting themselves in the foot. It's like the money that we're talking about. It's not all just about the money. It's really about the respect. And when you then say, and that money is often a signifier of the respect societally. But when we say it's all about Caitlin Clark and it's not really about the rest of the women's game, that's like, that's disrespectful. Like that's not giving the women's game itself the respect that they feel that it deserves. And so that's why it's not hypocritical.
I think one, the first of all, the analogy that you gave, I mean, I'm glad you acknowledged that it was a bad analogy because it wasn't, it's not like Caitlin Clark coming into the league is something that was unethical. Or whatever.
Yeah, right? No, but the point I'm making is not whether it's ethical or not. I'm just saying that not all money is good money, right? You don't just want to make money however all the time.
Here's the thing, right? When I watch an NBA game, there's a reason why I don't watch a team like the Pistons play basketball. It's because they don't have anyone on their team that makes me want to tune in and be like, watch that game. But when I watch the Nuggets, it's because hey, Jokic is my favorite player in the league to watch. I love to watch this guy play. I might watch a Lakers game because I love to watch LeBron play basketball, right? There is, and so it's also the idea that, look, your sport is not in a, you're not in a play. You know the expression, beggars can't be choosers? And I'm not calling these women that are in the WNBA.
Yeah, you are. You actually are. No, you literally are.
No, I'm not. It's an analogy.
You literally are. No, you can't. It's a saying. You can't be like, I'm not calling them beggars, but you know the expression, beggars can't be choosers? That's not how that works.
It's what that expression represents. For example, like Jordan, if I'm an undergraduate student, right, and I want to gain some research experience, right? And there's a lab and there's a PI who's willing to take me on and give me that experience that I need. But, you know, I don't really like the project that I'd be working on. But I don't have any other options, let's say, right?
But they slap you in the face and you don't have any other options. They slap you in the face.
They're not slapping them in the face. People, the discourse around Caitlin Clark is not that the women's basketball game sucks. It's that these people are tuning in to watch these games. A large part of the people that were not previously tuning in are tuning in because Caitlin Clark is an exciting basketball player, and so they enjoy watching her play. It's not disrespectful to say that because these people enjoy, just like I tune into the NBA to watch my favorite basketball players play basketball, it's not disrespectful to say that these people are tuning in to watch they're a player that they find exciting play basketball. And the idea that you've been asking people to tune in and support your product, and they are, but it's like how the support is coming is not good enough, I think is hypocritical personally.
To me, right, like when I say it's like they're, you know, it's like, oh, the person disrespects you, the person slaps you, like whatever it is. It's the point I'm making is not that this is necessarily the equivalent of being slapped in the face all the time by your primary investigator, but that people have different things that they care about, right? And different things that are not just the specific thing that they're asking for that are beyond that. And so for them, maybe the way this attention is coming that does not necessarily seem to be about, oh, actually women's basketball is really cool. It's just, oh, we're rooting for this white girl against all the rest of us. That might be the part where a lot of the women who are currently in the league feel like they're not getting the same kind of respect that they deserve, right? Like the kind of dialogue around Caitlin Clark making the Olympic team when she may not be one of those best athletes who's actually there. And the idea that they're just someone who's going to go to the Olympics and will just like sacrifice their spot because that's going to make more people watch. It's like the whole point is that people are supposed to be excited about watching women's basketball, not just watching Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, but how
I understand.
How do people become interested in sports, right? There's when they have figures what, in the sport.
I watch football just to watch football every week, right?
Football, I think, is one major exception because the players on the field are so anonymized. Because they have their helmets on, you don't see their face. When I watch the Premier League, for example, again, you're watching to see certain players, like having rooting interest because you understand who the different figures are in the game is always going to make a game more entertaining and pull eyes to that. Now, I'm not saying she should have made the Olympic team. I agree. If she's not good enough to make the team, that you shouldn't then add her onto the team just for that. But yeah, and we've been going on for a long time. But okay, go ahead. I want you can wrap it up.
All right, that's all we got for time. I know I gotta get out in a rush. Thank you to Alex, your friend who produces this show, for helping out behind the scenes. And come back next Sunday to hear what we've got to say about chapter 1118. In the meantime, we are your friends who read One Piece. Help us get more friends by liking our show on Spotify, sharing, giving 5 stars, and following us on YouTube at Friends Who Read One Piece to see Abraham's ugly mug on all the thumbnails. Also, we're up to like 30 followers on Twitter, so follow us at FWRP Pod for hilarious One Piece content from our friend Joaquin and new episode notifications. Thanks for listening, and peace.
Take it easy.